This episode of Love to Sew is brought to you by Merit Makes. Merit Makes offers high-quality apparel fabrics for home sewists who want to create their own everyday modern wardrobe. This mother-daughter team is dedicated to helping makers get their hands on amazing garment fabrics.
Merit Makes is offering 20% off all orders from November 13th to December 17th using the code LOVETOSEW. Go to meritmakes.com and enter the code LOVETOSEW to get 20% off your order. That's meritmakes.com. And now, on to the show.
Hello and welcome. I'm Helen.
And I'm Caroline.
And we love to sew. This is a podcast for makers where we talk about sewing a handmade wardrobe and bring you interviews with inspiring creatives and small business owners in our community.
Today we are chatting with Harriet Johnson, the sewing blogger and YouTuber behind The Little Dressmaker and founder of Clothing Care Co. Harriet has a passion for extending the life of our beloved garments by taking the time to care for them properly. We talk about visible and invisible mending, proper washing techniques, how to store different fabrics, and of course, stain removal.
It's more sustainable.
Oh, good one.
Thanks, I'm really proud of that one.
On the first go, too.
Oh, I had it planned.
We're professionals. Hello, Harriet. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so excited to chat with you. So can you start us off by just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yes, of course. I'm Harriet, and I'll start off by saying that I have what seems like way too many different social medias and blogs and things. I'm very selfish on that front. But I am obviously English, and I have a YouTube channel called The Little Dressmaker and also a blog called The Little Dressmaker, and I also run Clothing Care Co.
Awesome. And we would love to hear how you got started with sewing and when you learned to sew.
I kind of got started by a complete fluke, really. I started by knitting, and I got really into the knitting podcasts and things. I went right in at the deep end. I was watching them every day, all day. And it was mostly Katie from Inside Number 23. And then I realized that she did sewing as well, which was something that I'd never really thought of because no one around me sews. Like, my nana never did. My mum never really did. So it was kind of something that I'd never thought of. And at school, when we did textiles, when the bobbin ran out of the sewing machine, I just kind of panicked and moved on to the next one. So I'd kind of signed myself off of that. But when I saw that everyone that was knitting had been sewing as well, I thought, oh, I might as well give it a try, because knitting, as much as I had done, kind of was making my hands hurt a bit too much. So I went round to someone's house, and sort of because I knew that they had some old sewing patterns, and I raided one from a magazine back from like 2005 or something, went and bought some fabric, which looking back was completely the wrong choice for the pattern. And I did it all by hand, which was quite a commitment, but I didn't want to buy a sewing machine straight away because in case I hated it, I tend to kind of jump right into hobbies and then give up after a little while. So I did it all by hand. It took a very long time, and it is not something I'd ever wear now, to say the least. But it's still in my wardrobe, and it's a good sentimental thing to have. And that was only 2.5 years ago now, I think. So I haven't been sewing that long, but I've definitely thrown myself into it.
I love that you say that you would never wear it, but that you kept it. I also have some of the first things that I made, and yeah, I would never wear them out, but it's nice to have those as evidence of when you started to sew.
Yeah, I think everyone has that. I think I've never met anyone that does wear the first thing that they've made. I think everyone kind of agrees that the first thing is something that should never be spoken about again. Like the first thing I knitted, it was a really horrendous red scarf. And for some reason, when I gave it to my boyfriend, he still wears it, and it's awful, and I don't want to be seen around him wearing it. But that's the reason I carried on sewing, is because everyone was so encouraging about that first dress, which was so bad. It was so important to me that they sort of supported it, because otherwise I wouldn't have carried on.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that, because the first thing I knit was a hat that my partner also still wears. So
is it any good?
I mean, it was okay. It had a lot of mistakes, but I appreciated the fact that I made something that was wearable and that I actually knit something. And it's such an accomplishment when you're just getting started.
Definitely.
Yeah. So you mentioned your YouTube channel and your blog. So when did those things come into play?
I can't actually really remember starting either of those. I think it was just a spur of the moment decision, really. Like I said, the reason I got into sewing in the first place was because I've been watching other people's vlogs and reading other people's blogs. So I think it was kind of more of something that I thought no one would ever watch or read. And it was just going to document the things that I'd been making or sewing or knitting or whatever. And then it was a bit of a surprise to me when people actually started reading them and watching them. So yeah, that was pretty good. And they're still going now. So I must be doing something all right.
And you mentioned you live in the UK. Do you live in London?
I live just outside of London. I'm 40 minutes out of London, so might as well be London, I suppose.
So do you get to go to like London sewing meetups and that sort of thing? Do you often interact with like all of the sewing personalities out there?
Oh, we're so lucky here. All of the sewing personalities, or a lot of them, tend to be London-based, which is very lucky for me. I do get invitations to the meetups and things, but a lot of the time I'm not very able to commit to them. So the ones that I have been to, like I've been to the Sewing Weekender, which was amazing. And I'm good friends with Rosa from Sewn. I'm sure everyone knows who she is. It's really nice to just kind of have the people close to you, right, like proximity wise, that you can talk to about sewing and maybe meet up or go shopping with. There seems to be a meetup on the go all the time, which is really great.
Yeah, we're always jealous when we see all the meetups happening in London. I think we might need to go there one day, Caroline.
I think so too.
I think so too. You should definitely come over.
And we love how open you've been on your blog and your YouTube channel about living with the illness that you live with. Can you tell our listeners a bit about that?
Yeah, that was something that I was kind of on the fence about whether to tell people about or not, but I'm really glad that I did. So I have a couple of different medical conditions. One is called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. There are lots of different types of it, but I have the hypermobility type, which means that there are lots of things that come with it, but I have chronic pain, a lot of dislocations during the day. So there's like every day my hips pop out, my shoulders pop out, my jaw, my ribs, everything just seems to fall out of its socket. And I've gotten very good at putting them back again, but it means that I'm in pain constantly. Like there's never a time where I'm not. And the thing that made me want to share that particular thing is because I know that a lot of people, young people especially, do suffer with it, but feel kind of embarrassed because it took such a long time for me to get diagnosed with that. The doctors were all saying, oh, it's growing pains, you'll grow out of it, which is funny because I haven't grown in about 14 years. But it was kind of when I was finally told that it was EDS, it was kind of a relief, but also felt a bit like a life sentence. So I wanted to share it online because it is a massive part of my life. And I think a lot of people in the sewing community do deal with a lot of different health issues. But at the same time, I feel kind of self-conscious about it because I use a wheelchair a lot of the time, but I never show that in my pictures. So it's kind of deciding what to show and what not to show, but it's nothing that I'm ashamed of. So hopefully that comes across.
I think it does. I think that's one of the beautiful things about the online world is that you can sort of be who you want to be online, and that doesn't have to include every aspect of your personal life. But I do like what you said in one of your posts about, you know, not wanting to be labeled as disabled, but it's also a huge part of who you are. And so you want to be able to share that with other people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've only very recently changed my blog and first Instagram from Hobbling Handmaids to The Little Dressmaker. But it was kind of a change that wasn't even because of not wanting to be seen as just a disability. It was just because I didn't like the name anymore. But I had a lot of, that was kind of the way that people found me at first, is through like seeing my disability and wanting to hear more about that. So I've really gotten a lot of really lovely messages from people who are kind of going through similar things, which has been really lovely.
Yeah, we recently did an episode about sewing struggles, and we heard stories from people with illnesses and other hurdles in their way when it comes to sewing. So we'd kind of love to hear your perspective on that, how you have dealt with setbacks when you're sewing or doing other creative things.
Yeah, I really liked that question, actually. I don't really consciously think about the things that I have to change, but there are a lot of things that I do change. But I also have seizures as part of one of my other medical conditions. And sewing really, really helps with those because I'm sitting in the same place. And with the things that I used to be able to do, like horse riding, running, all of those things before I realized what I had, I felt like I would never be productive or achieve anything ever again. So the feeling of having a flat piece of fabric and being able to turn it into something else while you're staying in the same place is something that I think that was the really big draw for me when it came to sewing. But I've made a lot of changes to the things that I do with my sewing. Like my machine has a stop and start button for if my ankles are having a particularly bad day. I have adapted scissors, which make it easier for cutting out. And I have things like lifted above my waist so that I make sure I never have to pick anything up off the floor. And it's just kind of a lot of things like that. But I think one of the main things is that I forget that I need to stretch every now and then. Otherwise, my dislocations get a lot worse and I get a lot stiffer, which seems like two opposite things. But for some reason, they seem to be linked. So I've made a little timer to keep on my sewing desk so that I'm reminded to get up and stretch, which I find quite useful. Someone actually commented and suggested that. So I'm very grateful to them for suggesting that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I think that we all forget to get up and stretch no matter who we are and what our situation is. When we're sewing, we get so into it and we forget to stretch. We forget to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, you forget to eat.
You know, it's just one of those all-consuming things.
Yeah, definitely. You get into the flow.
And you also mentioned that you are vertically challenged, as you call it on your blog. And I love that.
I am indeed. I'm very small.
So how tall are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I am 4'11¾".
Oh,
which
nice.
Is a very important extra bit.
Of course. Yeah, very important. So do you have any fitting advice for other petite sewists out there?
Well, I make a few changes. I mean, the obvious one is raising hems because everything seems to be massively long on me. Raising hems and raising the waistline of things. I don't usually have to alter darts or anything because I'm a bit disproportionate and I have quite a large bust. So I never really have to do anything for that. But I think at the moment, I've always been too scared to try proper trousers. So I feel like I'm going to have to make a lot of adjustments there. So it's just kind of been elastic so far, trouser wise. But I like to have something that is cinched in at the waist. Otherwise, I feel like I look a bit like a rectangle. So yeah, I always make sure that something goes in at the waist so that I look like a proper person shape.
That makes sense. And what about being in a wheelchair? You mentioned that you're in a wheelchair quite often. Does that factor into your decision-making when it comes to choosing what kind of clothes you want to make?
Yeah, it definitely does. It's, again, that's something that's kind of subconscious now that I've been doing it for such a long time. But sleeves are an especially big thing because you don't want to get the sleeve of something amazing and white or just a plain or lovely color or amazing fabric. You don't want to get that caught in a muddy wheel, which would be particularly gross. So I make sure that my sleeves are either, if they're slightly baggier, I make sure that they're shorter sleeves, or if they come in at the wrist, I want to make sure that they're kind of fitted along my forearm so that there's enough room for me to wheel about without them dragging across the wheels. And bodices, I haven't quite figured out yet. If I want something a little bit more flowy, that kind of hangs over the side a little bit sometimes. So I need to figure out a better way to manage that. But I usually have, again, something that comes in at the waist. And if I wear a big dress, if I'm in the wheelchair, because I do love to dress up if I'm in the wheelchair, because if I'm drawing attention to myself, I might as well go all out and wear something incredible at the same time. If I'm wearing a massive skirt, I kind of just fluff it out because I have to wear a seatbelt in my wheelchair because of my seizures. I sort of fluff it over the top of that and just make sure that it's all out in its pride and glory. And
oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I'm just imagining you with this beautiful big skirt.
Yeah. Skirt. I wear a lot of skirts when I'm in Shwila. It's such a cheesy name, Shwila, but I thought was really funny. No one ever appreciates it as much as I do.
I know. I love that so much. And your old wheelchair was named William. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. Oh, I'm so glad that you found that. I was going to mention it, but then I didn't want to seem too.
No,
but
it's genius.
The thing is, I named my wheelchair William, and then I met my boyfriend whose name is William, and I thought, oh my goodness, this just looks creepy. Like I've named it after him, but I hadn't. It was fine.
That's so funny. Oh my gosh. And Shwila has a story behind her as well.
Yeah, she does. She is custom built because I am so small. It took a long time to get her. I was very lucky. I had a lot of friends come together to help me raise the money to afford her. And I made a special dress for the charity evening that we had to raise the money for that.
Oh, that's so sweet. Kind. Yeah. She's pretty sexy looking, I have to say.
Oh, we'll have to put a photo in the show notes if we can.
Oh, yeah, I'll send you one. Yeah, she's great. I got to choose all the colors. And I was actually very much thinking about what she would match when I was wearing, which is why I went for white in the end as the main body color, because I was going to go for purple. But then I thought that kind of restricts what I want to be wearing, because I always want to match Shwila. She's part of me.
You have to color coordinate.
Exactly.
So I'm curious, because Helen and I have meetups on the brain, and I know you mentioned you don't get to go to a ton of them, but I would love to get your insight a little bit about meetups and attending meetups when you have a disability. If there's anything that you can share that can help us to do better, or people in the sewing community to do better and be more inclusive and sort of appreciate the needs of attendees with special needs. So do you have any advice for that?
Yeah, that's something that I know is really difficult for organizers to think of, because the majority of the people that are going to show up are probably going to be able-bodied. But the thing is that there are so many different kinds of walking aids and things. So there's wheelchairs, crutches, frames, everything. So I think, especially if it's something where you're actually going to be sewing with a sewing machine, the thing that I struggle with most with meetups in that respect, if it's a kind of sew-along sort of one, is having a presser foot. And if you kind of picture a wheelchair where the footrest is, there's never actually space for the presser foot, foot pedal to go on the foot bit of the wheelchair. I'm not explaining this very well.
No,
so it's kind of easier. It's easier to have a little step sort of in front of where the wheelchair is so that you can just stretch your leg forward a little bit to press that down. But if it was a meetup where everyone just kind of met up and went shopping, which is a very great kind of meetup, I think it's just kind of if you plan ahead as much as you possibly can and just make sure that the shops are accessible, because a lot of fabric shops especially don't have aisles big enough to go through in London anyway, especially the Gold Hawk Road. That is not particularly wheelchair friendly. It's just kind of making sure that people are going to be able to get through and look at the fabrics. And just kind of for everyone there to sort of know that if someone is in a wheelchair or using an aid, it doesn't mean that they can't stand up, which I know is a strange thing to have to think about, because I'm in a wheelchair, but sometimes when I'm in the wheelchair, I need to get up and have a stretch. I'm not sort of able to stay in there the whole time. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that if you are in a wheelchair, you can get up quite a lot of the time, but you feel sort of embarrassed if you are in one, that if you do get up, people will think that you're kind of faking or something like that. So it's just kind of being supportive and supported by the people that you're with really is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And have you found that when you've attended meetups that people have been that kind of supportive and good positive energy?
Oh, definitely. The sewing community is definitely the most supportive place I've ever been, especially the meetups. Everyone's so lovely. They're always asking if they need to reach fabric for me to bring down or just things, because I am the English people and British people are so rubbish at asking for help. So it's quite nice sometimes to be prompted. But I know that some people don't really like it if someone says, oh, do you need help with that? And they get a bit defensive, but I'm not like that personally. But everyone's always so lovely and they understand if I need to take a break. Sometimes, especially fabric shopping, I get very tired very quickly when I'm touching things and moving about a bit. So it's useful if maybe there's kind of sit down breaks or a coffee break in the middle of the day, just so that if you are needing a break, I'm sure people that don't have a disability will probably want a break at some point as well. But having breaks during meetups is always really great and useful.
Yeah, no kidding. And I love what you said about the aisles in fabric shops, because I think that's useful for anyone who's going to open up a fabric shop in the future. We get a lot of questions about people wanting to open up stores and to consider things like accessibility when you're setting up your layouts, and that people can reach things and get around. And I think that's awesome advice.
It's things like that. And as well, getting into the shop is if there's a flat entrance through the door, and also the counter where you pay for your fabrics and the cutting tables for the fabrics, they're always very much at waist height for standing people. So it's useful if there's even like a shorter section where people can look at the fabrics properly, or pay where they're kind of more that their face isn't below the area where the other person can see you is always great.
This is all really great advice. Thank you for sharing all that.
Thank you for asking.
We're also curious about the story behind your studying textiles in university, because there's a little bit of a story behind that. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, there is a story behind that, because originally I was actually going to go to university to study philosophy, because that was my favorite subject at school. And we were at a school that really, really pushed university. And it was kind of, if you didn't want to go to university, they didn't really have any other options for you. So I did already feel quite pressured to go to university, but I found one that I really, really loved. It looked amazing. Me and my mum went to go and have a look around, and I was on crutches the day that I went around. And it was in London, because I knew that I wanted to go to a London-based uni. And we were looking around, the building was amazing, the location was amazing. And I was asking about their kind of protocol for if I was unwell one day and I wouldn't be able to make it to a lecture. And they were saying, oh, yeah, you can definitely do that. We'll record it, we'll send it to you, or whatever. You can Skype in, anything, we'll definitely do that. Because it is technically a legal right that you should be able to somehow access the lectures, even if you're not able to get there. And I went through the application process. I got really far. I was waiting for my second interview, I think it was, because I'd had a phone interview. And then I suddenly got an email where they said, oh, we've just realized that you're in a wheelchair and we shouldn't have allowed you to get this far into the application process because we can't accommodate you. And I sent them I had it all in writing that they'd promised me that they would be able to accommodate me. But they kept kind of saying that it wasn't going to be possible for them to do that because of the kind of building that it was or something. They wouldn't be able to get a stair lift or whatever. But that kind of really put me off the whole process, which I was sort of iffy on anyway. I wasn't 100% sure as to whether I wanted to go to uni. But at that point, I hadn't actually started sewing very seriously. So it was sort of a blessing in disguise, because now I would hate to be at uni studying philosophy and I would much rather be doing what I was doing. So I ended up finding a local college course, and I thought, well, if there was this uni that I think I was perfect for, I had the grades for, and they still said no, I might as well apply for this course that I have no experience for. I've never done a textiles class really in my life, apart from the compulsory ones that I was rubbish at. And then I suddenly got in off of my portfolio that I'd put together in about 2 weeks, that I'd really rushed to get everything right for. And that kind of just really boosted my confidence, and it really made me want to carry on with sewing. And I was so glad that the other uni rejected me in the first place.
Yeah, it's so funny how life works, because sometimes, you know, you have setbacks, but then you end up doing something that you're like meant to do in the end, you know? So I love that story so much. And I'm curious about what drew you to textiles, because you had a little bit of an interest in sewing and then you were trying to think of a plan B. So what is it about textiles that drew you in?
I'm not even really sure. I just have a real thing for just fabric in general, as well as making. It's just fabric. I love knowing what's in it, how it's made, and how you can look after it, which is kind of the whole Clothing Care Co. idea, that I just wanted to learn as much as possible about actual fabric and textiles and how you can use it to make certain drapes or just make a garment look so different based on what fabric you use in the first place. So it's not a usual kind of interest to have, but I was quite avidly into it.
It makes a lot of sense. I love textiles too, so yeah. I totally get it.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about Clothing Care Co. then. How did that come about? How did that get started? And what exactly is Clothing Care Co.?
I'll start off with what Clothing Care Co. is. It's kind of just what it says on the tin, really. It's the idea that we make our clothes. So it's kind of specifically targeted to people that do make their own clothes or make clothes for other people. But I also wanted it to be relevant to people who didn't buy their own clothes. But we put so much effort into making our clothes or buying our clothes. So if you think about it, it's like you find the pattern, you find the perfect fabric, you put it all together, you cut it out, you inevitably lose one bit and then have to cut it out again and then find the original bit under a cat or something. And then you spend ages sewing it and putting it all together, and then there's loads of cups of tea that go cold. So you put so much effort into actually making something. And then most of a garment's life is you wearing it and it being in your wardrobe or in a drawer. And how you store things and how you wash and mend things and the effort that you put into your clothes really do have an impact on how long they last. But it's not something that we're encouraged to do anymore. And there's a whole thing about sustainability at the moment, and we're all expected to want to be really sustainable and do a lot of things, but we're still not really taught how to look after those things, which is why I wanted to start Clothing Care Co., because I wanted to learn more about that. And I was finding that my original blog, which is now The Little Dressmaker, at the time was Hobbling Handmaids, I was finding that I was writing more and more about clothing care anyway. So I thought I might as well just dedicate a whole new website to it. And I haven't looked back since.
We love this concept. You share so much great information on your site about caring for clothing. And I love that you're talking about extending that love for sewing into, you know, the after sewing time when the garment's actually in your wardrobe and in your life and maintaining it. And we do talk so much about sustainability on the podcast as well and all the different things that we can do. But the number one thing you can do is just wear the clothes you have. And in order to do that, you have to take good care of them. So I really love this approach. And it's so cool that you are becoming a resource for people for this information.
Oh, thank you very much.
So are you the only sewist in the whole world that actually wants to do other people's mending?
You know what? I think I might be. I'm definitely saying now, I don't want to do alterations. Don't come to me with something that you want the hem brought up to. Take that to a tailor, please. But I do love mending holes, tears, and snags. They're just, oh, I love those. I love mending. I love a bit of visible mending, invisible mending. I just waffle about it to my mum for ages and she sort of just nods her head and I can tell she's sort of zoned out. But I'm glad that I have people that want to listen.
We haven't talked about visible mending or invisible mending on the show a ton. So I'd love to get your take on that. Like, what do you mean by invisible mending? Is it actually invisible or is it just the difference between mending that's meant to be seen and not meant to be seen? Like, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think I'm not really sure if my definition is kind of a universal one, really, but I consider invisible mending to be something that is meant to blend into what the garment already looks like. So you don't want it to stand out on purpose. You kind of choose a color that is the same as it was before, or you patch it with the same or a very similar fabric, or you just kind of want to hide the fact there's been any sort of irregularity in the item of clothing. But visible mending, which is my personal favorite, is where you kind of draw attention to the fact that something has been worn and ripped and or whatever, and you sort of make it a feature of the clothing, which I think now thinking about it, and I'm going to go off on a tangent here and you can cut this out if you want to, but I think thinking about it, that's kind of like a reflection of me personally, that I know that I have bits that fall out and I have to put them back in, but I make it a feature of me. Like, I'm so proud to have my wheelchair that I really love and I'm lucky to have, but it's sort of like that, but with clothes, if that makes sense. That's the only analogy that I can think of, is that you make it a feature of that part of the clothing so that people can ask you questions about it and you can just have a bit more fun with mending it.
No, I love that. And we've talked about Boro and Sashiko on the show before and how it's this beautiful application of mending that has, you know, loads and loads of history, and it can be such a beautiful addition to any of your handmade clothes or any of your existing ready-to-wear clothes as well. So it's cool that you're doing so much of that.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. I think it definitely adds to the history, and it kind of emphasizes the stories that your clothes have.
This episode is sponsored by Merit Makes. Merit Makes is a mother and daughter owned fabric shop that was founded earlier this year. They provide a trusted resource for sewists who are looking to create garments they will rely on for daily wear. Along with basics, they also source unique and interesting fabrics that are not widely available.
Merit Makes is based in St. Louis, Missouri, but they ship worldwide. They're focused on providing fabrics for an everyday modern wardrobe, helping home sewists create garments that are durable and feel amazing.
Merit Makes fabrics are primarily made from natural fibers, and when possible, fabrics that are eco-friendly, such as organic cotton, Tencel, bamboo, and soy substrates. They strive to provide customers with as much information as possible about all the fabrics, and they offer a free swatch service.
Check out their fall fabric collection, which includes soy cotton spandex knits in an array of super saturated colors. The collection also includes a unique herringbone French terry. It's 100% organic cotton, thick, squishy, and super snuggly.
Merit Makes is offering 20% off all orders from November 13th to December 17th, U.S. Central Time, using the code LOVETOSEW. Go to meritmakes.com and enter the code LOVETOSEW to get 20% off your order. That's meritmakes.com, and we will link it in the show notes.
Woohoo! So let's talk about some of the benefits of taking the time to care for our clothes. I think you had a blog post up where you listed a bunch of benefits. So can you go through some of those with us?
Yeah, definitely. I think that was my very first blog post that I put up on Clothing Care Co. So I'm going to have to cast my mind back to that. But so there are lots of reasons why you should put the effort into looking after your clothes. So the first one is that they'll last longer, which is kind of a no-brainer, because the fact that you're putting in a little bit more effort into looking after your clothes, it does make them last a lot longer. So if there's something that you really, really love, like an item of clothing that has really loads of sentimental value to you or has been really pricey and you kind of feel a little bit guilty about buying, if you just kind of put that little bit of extra time into it, it doesn't have to be every day, but you just make sure that it's hung up or folded properly and you clean it like you should and you use the right detergent or whatever with it, it just, you want something to last as long as possible. And the second one is kind of, you've spent that time making it or buying it. So like I said earlier, if you've made something, you've put a lot of time into it from when you've bought the fabric to once you've made it into something. But that's also true with if you're buying something, you have to think about buying it and then you have to spend the money on it and you put a lot of time into your clothes, whether you realize it or not. And that's kind of something that people don't really think about. But if you put that effort into your clothes, it makes sense, really. And then it's also a lot more cost efficient. So if you have an expensive coat or something, and you know that you kind of could get away with putting it in the washing machine, or a silk blouse, and you think you could get away with putting it in the washing machine, it's usually best to put the effort into hand washing it or getting it professionally cleaned, because in the long run, if you ruin it by washing it the wrong way, it's going to be a lot more expensive to replace it or try and find something similar than it would be to get it just cleaned once a year, even if it just makes more sense. And the whole prevention is better than cure thing, because it's, even if you have really good intentions and you know that you want to mend something if it gets broken, it's just much easier to prevent it getting broken in the first place. So just putting that care into your clothing, it's just going to make them last longer, whether you have to mend them or not.
There's so much great advice in there. I especially love your washing machine point, because I am the kind of person who's constantly taking risks with my washing. And I'm like, this pink thing used to bleed, but it probably won't bleed this time, right?
I used to
putting it in anyway.
I used to do that same thing too.
Yeah. And I also used to buy like the cheapest detergent I could find because I, you know, didn't want to spend too much money on laundry detergent. But then I got to thinking about how I put all this effort, like you were saying, into my handmade wardrobe and a lot of money and time, and I should be buying better detergent to help my clothes last longer. So can you talk a little bit about detergents and what to look for, or maybe if you have a brand that you really like?
Yeah, there's a lot. I'm very lucky and I still live at home, so my mum does a lot of my washing for me, but I give her the tips on the detergent, so I'm still qualified to talk about it. It's something that, again, a lot of people don't really think of, but detergent and washing is actually one of the biggest categories for how it impacts your clothing's lifespan. And so if you think about it, about the different kind of fabric in a garment, so usually it's a combination, especially if something has a lining, you always want to cater for the most delicate thing in that garment, which is why a lot of coats and things need to be professionally cleaned, because the lining and the self fabric do require different kinds of care. So you always want to make sure that if there's a combination, even if it's acrylic and something else, you want to make sure that you're looking after the most delicate thing in that list. And if it's wool or a natural fiber, like silk or wool especially, then you definitely want to get a detergent that is specifically for one of those. And if it says hand wash, it's probably better to dedicate the time to hand washing it, especially if it's something that you really want to look after for a long time. But I don't want to be the kind of preachy person that tells you if it says hand wash, always hand wash it. Because if you've had an experience where it's been okay in the washing machine, as long as you're being careful, then it might be okay. But I personally always hand wash anything that needs hand washing or is a fabric that might need it. But yeah, especially with silk and wool, you want to make sure that you have a detergent that you might want to invest a little bit more money in. And I'm sure a lot of the people that listen to the podcast who do knit will know a lot about the detergents that are specifically for wool garments that you've hand knit, that you use for kind of blocking and things. They are really worth investing in, because I've done lots of research, I've done lots of reading and testing and things, and those special ones do definitely make a difference, and they also smell great too, so they're worth getting. There's also the difference between bio and non-bio detergents, which I really didn't get when I first started reading about clothing care, and I'm sure it was a really obvious thing that I should have known, but I think people kind of look at it and see bio or non-bio and they just sort of guess at whatever's cheaper or something, but there is actually a difference between them, and I've written a blog post on that if I just want to plug myself, but it'll probably explain it much better than I will explain it now. But basically, biological detergents have enzymes in that attack protein-based stains. So they're really good for cottons, but bio detergents shouldn't be used with very delicate fabrics like synthetic silk or wool, because they can damage the fibers a bit. But if you have a stain, bio is a really good one to go for, but non-bio is better for sensitive skin or kind of more delicate items of clothing.
That's a great tip. And we'll definitely link that blog post in the show notes, because I'm sure our listeners would love to read a little bit more about that. And I loved your point about hand washing and just thinking about the longevity of garments. It kind of made me think about an analogy of like putting dishes in the dishwasher. Like, it's so easy to put your dishes in the dishwasher, and obviously it's super tempting, but some things are just better hand wash. It's going to mean that they're going to last longer, because heat makes things break down quicker, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think if we sort of look at it that way and think about, you know, you're just making your things last longer if you're not putting them in the washing machine. And obviously we want our handmade garments to last longer, even though it's so tempting to throw things in the washing machine.
I know
it
is. And I know that I kind of sound like a preachy mom a lot of the time when I say things like that, but there is actually, it does do it. Like, heat does damage fibers, but especially drying, tumble drying is so bad for a lot of your clothes, and it makes them shrink for starters, but it definitely affects the life of the fibers in the fabrics. So where you can, air drying things is so much better than tumble drying. But I do understand that if it's the end of a long day, you might be more inclined to just whack something into the tumble dryer. But if you can spare a thought for the future of your clothes, it is much better if you have the space to put them on a rack.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it's preachy at all. I mean, I think that's why we have you here on the show. We want to talk to you about caring for clothes. So I think it's awesome that you're offering all this advice. Oh, and I'd love to pick your brain a little bit about air drying clothes. So I know that there's like a couple of different options there. You can hang your clothes, or you can lay them flat, or you can sort of hang them flat on a drying rack. So are there certain fabrics that are better laying flat to dry, certain fabrics that are better hanging? Do you have any thoughts or advice about that?
Yeah, there's definitely some fabrics that are going to be a lot better if you just kind of lay them on the floor. As in the way as they might be, they will definitely dry better, some of them. So especially knits or things that have stretch, especially if it's kind of heavy fabric, like a heavy knit or kind of a really weighty fabric, you want to make sure that once it's out of the washing machine, if you kind of smush it into a little ball to get all the excess water out rather than wringing it. Definitely don't ever wring a knit or stretch anything. Don't do that. And then if you just kind of squish out some of the water and then lay them onto a towel or whatever, and you can press out the last bit of the water, sort of arrange it into the shape that it should be when it's dry, and just kind of let it do its thing. You have to might turn it over every now and then or put it onto a different towel. But that will definitely affect how it dries, because if you hang something that is heavy, especially because wool, it takes on so much water when it's wet, it will pull the seams down. And if the shoulders aren't reinforced or the waistband isn't reinforced, it's just not built to have that much weight, and it will really pull the garment out of the shape it's meant to be. So I would say on the whole, t-shirts are fine to hang up to dry because they're not that heavy and they don't get that heavy when they're wet. But usually you'll probably be able to tell if something is particularly heavy. It's usually just chunky knits or kind of longer dresses or something that feels like you can take your common sense. I mean, I trust your common sense that you'll be able to figure it out. But most things are fine to be hung up, or even if you kind of lay them half up so that most of the weight is supported. It's just kind of making sure that there isn't weight dragging anything down that could stretch.
Right. And I'm embarrassed to say that I've never laid something on a towel to have it dry. So I'm curious, would you put the towel like on a table or just on the floor? Or like how do you do that when you do it for yourself, like in your apartment or
your home?
It's
kind of wherever you're going to have space, really. Most of the time, if you can get as much water out as you can before you put it onto that towel, it will just speed up the drying process. But if you kind of lay the towel onto a table or the floor or wherever you decide to put it, and then sort of fold the towel so that it's like a little sandwich, so that your clothes are in the middle, and then press out some of the water and then unfold it again and then sort of just leave it wherever it is. I know that it's really difficult for some things that are massive, but it's kind of just wherever you have space. Just if you could pop it in a cupboard somewhere or something, then that should probably be fine. But the sun does really help to dry things out.
Yeah, in my mind, it feels like, oh, that would take up so much space. And I don't know, but it's interesting because I'm thinking about doing it and it feels almost like it makes so much sense for us to spend that time caring for our clothes and making that space to allow them to have like their moment to dry. Like it feels almost like an ode to our handmade clothes. Like you love what you made, so take that time to like let it air dry.
Yeah.
And like
a caring
sandwich
ritual.
It in a towel. Like I love that. I'm gonna have to try that when I get home.
The things that do need to be sandwiched in their towels don't usually need washing all that often. It's usually really chunky cardigans or, what do you call them in America? We call them dressing gowns here.
Or like robes?
Yeah, robes. Usually they don't really need washing that often. Although they wouldn't need sandwiching, so you can just ignore that bit. Things that do need sandwiching don't need washing very often. But even if you don't have that much space on the floor, there's nothing that doesn't mean that you can make your little towel clothes sandwich on top of a wardrobe or something where there is space, and you can, as long as you don't forget about it, then there'll be space somewhere for it, I'm sure.
And what about after the clothes are dry, when it comes to just storing them in the wardrobe? There's also some interesting information on your site about hanging versus folding and putting away and different fabrics that are better suited to those things as well.
Oh, you've done your reading. Yeah, there are definitely some things need to be folded and some things need to be hung up. That was actually one of the first blog posts that I wrote on that as well, because it does everything. There are kind of four main categories for clothing care, which is as you're making, which is only relevant to those of us who make the clothes that we're caring for. And then mending is the last one or the second one. There's not really a particular order, but there's as you're making, mending, washing, and storage. And they all work together. I wouldn't say any of those are more important than the others. But I think it was the storage that was the most interesting to me at first. So that was one of my most, I really enjoyed doing that one. But some clothes, the clothes that need to be hung up are sort of wovens. So just anything that is cotton or just doesn't have any kind of stretch content, they're usually fine to hang up, especially if it is prone to wrinkling, like linen, that's really great to hang up. But if it does stretch or if it's kind of got a lot of embellishments on, it's usually better to fold things. Like cardigans and jumpers, while you might feel like it's going to take up way too much room to fold them, they are really a priority to fold because the weight of the gravity and just the distribution of the weight on a hanger is going to really pull the shoulders out of shape. And it just kind of, if you think about it, it does make sense that it would do that. But yeah, it's just those things really need to be folded if you can. Jeans, kind of, there are things, I talk about it properly in that blog post, but there is kind of a hierarchy for what does need to be hung and what should be folded. So if you don't have space for some things, there are things that should kind of be folded, but are fine if they do get hung up. But it's kind of the choice of the clothes hanger as well, which is sort of something that sounds so boring, but it does have a big impact as well. How it distributes the weight of the item of clothing. So that's just something to think about, even though it might be boring for you. It is something that does make a difference, believe it or not.
Yeah, no, I mean, I used to have these really cheap wire hangers in my closet and they would make these weird little dents in my clothes.
Yes.
Because they have no depth to them. They're just a thin little wire. And I upgraded to some nice wooden ones and it definitely helps the everything
hang
better.
That's good to hear because you would have heard me cry on the podcast if I had heard that you still had those.
Get rid of your wire hangers, people.
Get rid of them, please, for my sake.
And back to the certain fibers or fabrics not being suitable for folding. You mentioned in that blog post, sorry, we keep going back to this blog post
because
it's so great, about linen and how linen garments should be hung and not folded because eventually if they're, you know, folded and left for a while, those creases won't come out. So would you also recommend a different way of storing linen fabrics, like for fabrics that we have in our stash?
Yeah, storing linen fabric is different to storing normal fabric as well, because ideally all the fabric that you have that hasn't been made up into anything yet, it does kind of stay better if you roll it. But that is, it would be hypocritical of me to say that you have to do that because I don't do that. But linen is really important to roll because it has this feature that if there's a crease in the same place for a certain amount of time or if it's folded repeatedly in the same place, because there's no stretch or give in the fibers of linen, it will end up just kind of creating a rip in the fabric, which wouldn't be great. I'm sure you can agree, wouldn't be great. So just kind of rolling it really gently and then just sort of keeping it wherever, as long as there's air that's circulating and it's a dry place and the sun isn't directly on your fabrics, that's just the best way to store linen, really.
Awesome. That's great. I mean, you are just a fountain of knowledge. And we're so, so grateful that you're here on the show to talk about all of these things. And you also have a book called The Little Book of Stain Removal. And we have to mention it because it's so cute and it's so great. And you sell it in your store in both ebook form and physical book form. So can you give us a couple of stain removal tips and maybe tell us a little bit about the book as well?
Yes, of course. I got the idea for the book from an incident that I keep telling people because it was like a light bulb moment for me. But basically, we were at a family gathering, and I remember this so clearly. We were at a family gathering, and I was sat next to my cousin, and he had a glass of red wine, and I was wearing my favorite white shirt, and a dog went past the window, and I got excited, and I kind of jumped a little bit, and I elbowed his red wine all over myself. And I was panicking. I looked like a stab victim. I went to the bathroom. I kind of stripped off as I ran. And I just shoved it under the tap and I was trying to Google how to get red wine out. And I found that every single website was telling me something different. Like some were swearing by things that other things were just kind of saying, no, no, definitely don't do that. So that was kind of my, if you were wondering, my red shirt is no longer. That was the final, that really killed it, that did that incident. But it made me want to make something that was really definitive, and it just told you clearly and thoroughly with kind of reasons, but not so many reasons that it's boring, that why things work and how you should treat certain stains. And I know that not everyone is going to be able to treat something straight away. So there's also options for if a stain is slightly older and for different fabrics, because I really wanted to kind of cover everything that I could. So I can't remember exactly how many stains are in there, but it's quite a lot. I did a lot of work on it and I'm really proud of it, even if I do say so myself.
You should be proud. It's such a great idea. I have to get a copy of it because I just love the idea of having a little book that I can refer to anytime I stain my clothes, which happens embarrassingly often. So having something that I can turn to that I know is a trusted resource and that I know you've done your research on, I mean, I think that's just an invaluable tool for sewists out there. What is it? Helen's putting up her hand. She wants to talk about me staining my clothes.
No, I don't. I mean, that's hilarious, but no. I wanted to ask, like, did you do kind of that infomercial style thing where you have a bunch of fabrics and you're like pouring various things on the fabrics and trying to get them out? Like, were you doing that
totally
level?
I was so inspired by the American infomercials. We don't really have those here, but I think they're hilarious. I love them. And I was just kind of making such weird concoctions and just tipping them onto scraps of fabric. I feel like my mom probably thought that I was having some kind of episode. I was just, the house was smelling of like vinegar and stuff all the time. I was trying so many different things because I wanted to make sure, obviously, that everything I was putting into the book actually worked. So yeah, my mum can attest to the fact that the house was covered in just weird colours and I was hunched over the sink all the time because I wanted all the things in the book to kind of be obviously things that worked, but things that you're likely to actually have around the house as well. So I'm not going to tell you to run off and get some kind of weird hair dye remover that you're not actually going to have. So it was a rough couple of months for my mum, I think, while I was doing all of that.
Well, we appreciate her sacrifice. And I would love to know, what was the final result of the red wine stain in a white shirt? Because I think that a lot of our listeners can relate to that problem.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, I had to say a few words and say goodbye to that shirt. The red wine never came out. But now, if that happened now, it would definitely come out because I've poured red wine all over a massive bit of white fabric and it all came out. So if it happened now, it would be fine, but that's kind of, that makes it sort of worse in a way because I know that I could have rescued that favorite shirt, but it's fine. I've made a copy of it. It's okay.
If only we could go back in time, right? Yeah. Can you tell us how you got red wine out or how we can get red wine out of our white shirts now?
There are actually loads of different ways that you can do it. So it depends on the fabric and everything really, but I've put in the book that I know that if you tip red wine all over yourself, there's probably a chance that you're not in a fit state of mind to go about getting a stain out at that time. But I said, if you've had the presence of mind to pick up that book in that time, then I had faith that you could kind of go all the way. So the important thing is to kind of keep it wet for as long as you can. So a lot of people say white wine. I mean, that's not going to do any harm. So just kind of keep it wet, but not soaked. So sort of damp, not wet. I should have said damp there. But if you keep it damp until you're able to treat it properly, and then kind of the easiest way to do it, because this won't damage delicate fibers or kind of hardier things like cotton, is to put salt or something, an absorbent powder onto it. First, so that it kind of sucks everything out, it sucks all the moisture out, and with that it should suck the color out. And then when you get to the book, or if you're not buying the book, I am actually planning on putting red wine stain removal out as a separate blog post, then you can choose whichever sort of method is the most sensible for what you're dealing with.
Awesome. Well, we really encourage our listeners to go check out your book and, of course, all of your awesome blog posts. Yes, Caroline, you have
something? I have one more question. I'm curious, is there a type of stain that just doesn't come out? Like, did you find that there's one kind of thing or a couple of things that just don't come out?
I did, yeah. Well, I've put a section in the book and I've also put that blog post up on my website. The things that I've put into the book are going to help probably 80 or 90% of the time, but there are some stains that just aren't going to be rescuable. Whether it's, I found that rust was actually one that was a really massive problem. There were a lot of things that I had to shout at because the rust just wouldn't come out. And it's actually quite difficult to stain something with rust. I had to go through quite a lot of effort to test that one. But yes, rust is really difficult, but I have got a whole couple of pages on covering stains that aren't going to come out because it is just a fact that that happens every now and then.
Oh, that's a good tip, though, that you can do some visible mending and just cover it up. Yeah. And it's like, it never happened. So you also are hosting a Mend It Month this month, in the month of November, and your episode's coming out kind of in the middle of it. So I hope there's still time for our listeners to get on board and join in with your month. So can you tell us about hashtag Mend It Month?
Yes. This was something that I started last year before I'd set up Clothing Care Co. And it's something that I just kind of did for myself because I am, well, I was, I'm much better now, but I was rubbish at getting to mending my clothes. I started with the best intentions. As soon as I noticed something needed mending, which is a big tip, if you notice something needs mending, please don't carry on wearing it. Just kind of put it to the side because it will make it worse. Even if you think that you're going to be fine, it will make it worse. I promise, because I've been there. But you just kind of put it to the side and think, yeah, I'll do that later. And then you get back to sewing what you were sewing, and then it's been there for about 6 months and you've completely forgotten about it, even if it's something that you could do in 5 minutes and that would be fine to wear again. But it was kind of that idea because I'd been talking to other sewists and they'd all sort of agreed that they were rubbish at mending as well. So I just kind of came up with it for myself. And the idea is that we all sort of mend together and we can encourage each other. And I have got 4 separate prompts, so it's one for each week. But it doesn't matter if you don't have something for one category, you can just kind of continue it, or you can just mend one thing for the whole month. I mean, as long as you're mending something, it's fine. I'm doing one thing for the whole month, which is my dad's jacket, which it had a silk lining, which is pretty much gone now. But that is my mending project for this month. But week one, so that one will already gone by the time this podcast goes out. But week one was kind of general mending, like patching holes or tears or broken zips or popped seams or whatever. And then week two is finishing off those unfinished projects, which I definitely have a lot of in my sewing room. It's just things that you kind of got cross with and sort of abandoned. But that one was quite an important one for me, and that was the one that I did the most work on last year. And then week three, which I think will probably be just coming up as the podcast goes out, is going to be adjustments, which is my least favorite thing ever. So sort of taking up or letting down hems that need doing, or taking in or making waistbands or whatever bigger. But I've also kind of said that if there's something that you can't do, there's no shame in sort of taking it to a tailor, because you could give it a go if you have faith in yourself. There are so many amazing YouTube videos and tutorials and stuff online that I've used loads of, which are really useful to help just alter darts or seam lines or whatever. But just taking it to a tailor sometimes is necessary. And if you pay that little bit of money and it means that you're able to wear it again, then that's great and worth doing a lot of the time. And then the final week is, I've just called it jazzing up, but that kind of encompasses everything. Like if you've got something that you sort of have fallen out of love with, but you don't want to get rid of yet, it's sort of kind of covering up stains, or adding some embroidery or beading, or kind of just making something look slightly different so that you're more likely to wear it again. So just kind of refashioning, I suppose, would have been a better word than jazzing up, but it was a jazzy word. I wanted to use it.
You're zhuzhing.
Yes,
you're just bringing zhuzhing new life into something.
I would have put that, but I didn't know how to spell zhuzh.
Me neither.
It's actually really surprising, the spelling. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it's very weird.
Okay, you listeners, you have to go Google that for yourself. Oh, these prompts are all so interesting, and it's really getting me thinking about the pile of mending that I have. I have a pile of mending. I have a pile of work in progress sewing projects. I also have a pile of things that I've fallen out of love with, or that need little alterations, or need to let the waistband out, or whatever it is. So I fall into all of these camps, and it's nice to have the encouragement to get to that.
Well, you can go for longer than a month if you want to, but that's the plan. And there's also the hashtag on Instagram, hashtag Mend It Month. And at the end of November, I'm going to pick someone that's participated to give a copy of my book to, because I'm just so grateful for everyone that joins in.
Oh, awesome. I love it. And I'm sure by the time this episode comes out, there'll be a bunch of pictures on that hashtag. So listeners, go check it out. Go participate. It's such a great little challenge. And yeah, I hope it inspires people to do some mending. Mm-hmm.
I have mending for my partner too, which is embarrassing. He doesn't have that many clothes. So he's like, can you please fix the only pair of pants that I have?
I know. It's such a good point, Harriet, what you said about mending, like stopping wearing something when it needs to be mended. Helen and I were looking at each other like, oh geez, we totally wear our clothes to death. And I'm particularly thinking about jeans. My jeans tend to wear out a lot between the thighs.
That is exactly what I did last
year. And I mean, like, when I do actually take the time to mend them, it really extends their life. I mean, I have a pair of Lander pants that I mended like a good 6 or 8 months ago, and I've just been wearing them since then. So they were unwearable at the time when I needed to mend them. So it's a really great tip to just do it right away, because you're sort of, you know, preventing it from getting worse, and then you'll get to wear it for even longer. So I love that tip.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So our listeners can participate in Mend It Month just by following the prompts and using the hashtag.
Yep, definitely. I mean, you don't even have to follow those prompts if you don't want to. Those are just kind of ideas. But if you have something that you want to mend and it doesn't fall into any of those categories, just use the hashtag, and I will like every single photo that I see on the hashtag.
People should tag you too, right? At Clothing Care Co on Instagram.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm gonna kind of repost everything. I love getting involved.
Amazing. Yeah, and we love everything that you do for the community and all of your amazing blog posts, so we're gonna link everything in the show notes. And you have a discount for our listeners, right?
I do, yes, as a thank you for listening to me waffle for an hour or so. I have the discount Love to Sew. That applies to everything that's on the website, and it will not expire. So even if you're listening to this a year after it's come out and there are loads more things on the website, you can use it more than once. You can use it for forever. But yeah, that will be on there, and that will get you 10% off everything. And I do ship internationally if you would like a physical copy of the book.
That's awesome. Everybody go buy this book. I know I'm going to immediately after we finish recording, because I want to get my hands on a copy. I think it's so awesome. So can you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
Yep. I am at Clothing Care Co on Instagram, and Facebook is just Clothing Care Co. And then my website is clothingcareco.com. And then if you'd like to find kind of my personal Instagram and things, I am at The Little Dressmaker on Instagram and thelittledressmaker.com on my website, and I am The Little Dressmaker on YouTube. It's kind of very consistent all around.
I love it. Well, Harriet, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. We learned a lot, and we are sure our listeners did too.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
We did too. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for today's episode of Love to Sew. Thank you to our sponsor, Merit Makes. Go to meritmakes.com and follow at Merit Makes on Instagram for beautiful fabrics. And don't forget to check out that discount code in our show notes.
We're recording today in gloomy Vancouver, Canada. It's not that gloomy though, because your face is in front of me, Helen.
My face is sunshine.
Yes, it is. You can get in touch with us and get links for everything we talked about in this episode at lovetosewpodcast.com.
If you're loving the show and you want to help us out, you can support us on Patreon. Contribute $5 or more a month and you'll get access to our bonus episode feed. Go to patreon.com/lovetosew for more info.
You can find me, Caroline, at blackbirdfabrics.com and Helen at helenscloset.ca. Our show is produced by Sam Humphrey.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You all are going to go do your mending, right?
Go buy that book.